I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Welcome, everybody, to this very special episode of The American Idea. It has been a monumental Supreme Court term, the court handing down a lot of important decisions that have immediate and far-reaching consequences. And as always, we try to turn to one of our great friends and experts on the Supreme Court. Joining us today, Professor Josh Dunn. He has been a frequent guest on The American Idea, thankfully, an old friend of mine, and also an old friend of the Ashbrook Center and our programs for teachers. And in fact, I think Josh is actually in Ashland, Ohio, teaching in our master's program this week.
That's right. Having a great week with the teachers. It's always a lot of fun to be with them.
Well, thanks for taking the time this week. Josh, as many of you may know, is the executive director of the Institute of American Civics at the University of Tennessee. I want to put in a strong plug for the Institute that Josh is now leading. It's an important element, not only of the university system in the state of Tennessee, but as a model for the rest of the country, about thoughtful, engaged teaching and scholarship on American history and civics and our political tradition. So thanks, Josh, for taking that leadership role and for taking the time out of your day and your week to be with us on The American Idea.
Oh, thanks. It's good to be with you. It's always fun to talk about what the court did this past in its past term. So,
well, it seems to have done a lot. our listeners are some, of course, are, as you know, are, of course, citizens, some students, but also teachers who teach the Supreme Court, who like to think about the Supreme Court with their students. If you had to encapsulate in a word, a phrase, maybe it's an unfair question, but this term, how would you describe it?
So I think that the decisions that are going to have the longest lasting effect are ones around what you could call the administrative state and restraining the power of federal agencies and shaping their role in our governmental system. I think that those are the ones that are going to be most important. There are, of course, others involving presidential immunity. I think that that one could have some effects down the road, but I think some of the concerns about it are probably overstated. So, yeah, I mean, if you look at the key decisions of this term, though, going forward, I think it's going to be these ones surrounding administrative authority, agency authority.
All right. Let's talk about what you regard as some of the most important decisions. Maybe we should start in that area of the Supreme Court and the power of the federal executive bureaucracy.
Sure. So the biggest one is Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. This is where they overturned what's known as the Chevron Doctrine. And the Chevron Doctrine goes back to the 1980s. The principle behind the Chevron Doctrine was that administrative agencies, if they were interpreting ambiguous federal statutes, that they should be deferred to. And the federal and the Supreme Court overturned that precedent. And so that essentially gives the courts and particularly lower courts authority to overturn the decisions of federal agencies, even when, you might have an ambiguous statute. I think in the long term, though, what the court is hoping will happen with this decision is that it will force Congress to be more precise and clear in the authority that it actually delegates to administrative agencies. I think they're trying to force Congress to do its job with the decision.
So that's fascinating. The decision, as I think I remember, was a 6-3 decision.
Yes.
But the six justices did not simply agree, I think, on the grounds for why they wanted to strike down the Chevron Doctrine.
Yeah, that's correct. Chief Justice Roberts wrote the majority opinion, and that gives you a sense of I mean, I think when we look back on the Roberts Court, you can look at the decisions that he has chosen to write himself. Of course, the Chief Justice has the authority to assign opinions if the Chief Justice is in the majority. And you can get a sense of the Chief Justice's priorities by the decisions he assigns to himself. And you look back at the past few terms, many of the most important decisions do involve administrative power, and he's assigned them to himself. And so there are some disagreements with the majority, but I think the broad contours are fairly clear on this. And it's also, I think, pretty obvious that agencies are going to have to be a little bit more circumspect in how they interpret statutes. And I think there will be even a bigger effect on agencies, even though it doesn't involve what are known as agency advice or maybe with the Department of Education, what are known as Dear Colleague letters. I think this is kind of a shot across the bow of federal agencies to be a bit more circumspect in how they go about crafting rules and then also even offering advice that has not been gone through the rulemaking process.
Yeah, because as I understand it, Chief Justice Roberts argued in the decision that the Chevron doctrine violated a federal law. It didn't reach the constitutional issue, but then a couple of members of the court concurring said, I think we should go all the way to the constitutional issue. For our listeners, they sometimes think the court only interprets the Constitution. This seems like they decided this case based on interpreting a federal law.
Yes. So often a general policy for many of the justices is that if you don't have to go to the constitutional issue, you don't, because those decisions are considered more final than others, because the Constitution doesn't change. Congress can't change the Constitution outside of the amendment process that also then goes to the state. So they do try to resolve disagreements on statutory grounds, if at all possible. But then there has been some conflict on the Roberts Court among some of the conservative justices who think that he has not been willing to go far enough in reaching the constitutional issue. Roberts is known as a minimalist, and so that means he tries to only resolve the issue that's before him on the narrowest grounds possible. Now, this is still a pretty far-reaching decision, though, overturning the Chevron doctrine. I think, yes, that Roberts, he accomplished what he wanted to without reaching the constitutional issue. And so he wanted to leave it there.
What about other decisions along the lines of the administrative state? You mentioned this is one of a few that are actually very important this term.
All right. So you have a Security Exchange Commission versus JARCSI. This is a 6-3 decision. Also, the opinion was authored by Roberts, and this involved the in-house administrative courts with the SEC ruling that they are unlawful. There's been an attempt to curtail, again, some of the power of federal agencies. Often federal agencies combine legislative, executive, and judicial powers all in one. And the complaint about many of these in-house administrative tribunals is essentially this allows them to bring all of these powers to bear at once, and you aren't getting a fair treatment by the agency because the judges in these administrative tribunals are a part of the agency, there have been particularly with the SEC, there have been many complaints from even people I think like Mark Cuban who have complained about them, that because it's all done in house in the Federalist Papers, it talks about how combining all three forms of authority, executive, legislative, and judicial, and one set of hands is the very definition of tyranny. And that's been the complaint about these administrative agencies. And so this is an attempt to limit their authority so that they can't essentially write the rules, then prosecute, and then have their own judges apply the rules to the people who have been charged with violating them.
I think that some of our listeners might be surprised to hear that SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, as a federal agency, has the power to lay out the rules for securities exchange, stock market selling and buying and things. Then it has the power to enforce those rules. And then if it determines that someone may have violated those rules, it has the power to actually have them tried in front of an administrative judge who works for the SEC.
Exactly, exactly. So there have been longstanding concerns by some about whether or not this violates basic core constitutional principles. And again, this is an attempt by the Roberts Court to shape the authority of the administrative state and to narrow and cabinet.
And it was interesting to me noting this, that one of the arguments they made was, this is a violation of the Seventh Amendment, which, of course, I think a lot of our listeners think, wait, what's the Seventh Amendment?
Yeah, yeah.
That has to do with something with juries or something, doesn't it?
Right, right. So, yeah, there are fair trial issues that come up with this. So, this is one that, again, you're probably your average member of the public isn't quite aware of this. But they exercise kind of immense and up until now relatively unchecked authority on this, and so this is a pretty significant administrative state ruling.
So if you take these two together, Loper-Bright and then Jarczy, is it fair to say that you have? Did this come out of the blue? I guess I'm curious about this. Is this, you know, you've talked a lot of in previous conversations you had about kind of sometimes court cases do seem to come out of the blue, and sometimes they seem to, but they haven't really. They've been, you know, the groundwork has been laid over a long period of time. How would you describe these court decisions on administrative state power? Are they out of the blue, or have we been along the way?
Yeah, we've been building towards this for a while. And so we saw some precursors, even with the West Virginia versus EPA case, where they announced this major questions doctrine. And so the EPA couldn't regulate on the area of clean air in the way that it wanted to, because the court said this is a major question that Congress needed to weigh in on. That was a very recent case. You've also seen the conservative legal movement, which then has helped shape the judicial philosophy of the operating majority on the court, has been critical of the power of the administrative state for some time. There's some people who say this has been the goal of the Federalist Society all along, that some of these social issue cases aren't nearly as important to them as this the power of the administrative state. You also saw it. Well, there were a couple of other decisions I think that should probably be mentioned with this. There was the bump stock decision, Garland versus Cargill, and that involved the ATF interpreting the National Firearms Act to say that bump stocks were included within the scope of that act. And the court said, no, they were not. And they had to get an authorization from Congress if they wanted to regulate the bump stocks, which are these attachments to ordinary firearms that allow them to fire more rapidly. And then there was another decision that received even less attention, but it could end up being very significant, called Corner Post Incorporated versus Federal Reserve. That was another 63 decision. It was written by Barrett. And in that case, the court said that the six-year statute of limitations applicable to suits against the United States doesn't start until the plaintiff is actually injured by a final agency action. And the reason that was significant is that if the statute of limitations starts when the rule is announced, there's this window, and it would start right then. And so then once you get past that window, that's it. You can't bring a claim anymore. But since it's when the plaintiff is injured, you could foresee continuous challenges to rules issued by agencies, because you could have new entities created that didn't even exist when the rule was announced, but then they're created, and then they can claim that they've been injured. And so it just allows really all kind of ongoing challenges. And so for people who follow administrative law closely, I think that's a decision that's going to go down as a very significant one that flew under the radar and didn't get the attention that it deserved.
It does, as you were saying, it does really seem like this is an interesting term, because in the past, when you and I have talked about Supreme Court terms, we've talked a lot about the hot button social issues, the Dobbs case, for example, overturning Roe versus Wade. But this does seem to be a term where the court has dealt a lot with separation of powers questions, the powers of the judiciary, the powers of federal agencies. And of course, the case that you mentioned, Trump versus United States, the power of the president and the immunity right. of the president. Tell us a little bit about that case. It has received enormous coverage in the media.
Yes. So in that case, the question is whether or not presidents can be prosecuted, criminally prosecuted, for actions related to their core powers while in office, the core powers of their office. And what the Supreme Court said is that they cannot be prosecuted, criminally prosecuted, if what they did fell within their core powers. And then they also said that if it was, there should be presumptive immunity for other official acts, the kind of within the outer perimeter of their authority, but then there would be no immunity for unofficial or private actions. And so this affects the prosecution potentially. We don't know yet. It's really going to be sent down to particularly lower courts as prosecution of Trump by this special counsel, Smith, Jack Smith. It's going to be sent down for reconsideration. And so we don't know exactly how it's going to affect that. The most immediate effect is it's going to delay any trial of Trump. So there won't be any trial before the election now, almost certainly, because these other issues are going to be based on the decision on this decision are going to have to be sorted out. So there was some arguments that this essentially immunizes the president from any repercussions if they do something and they claim that it's within their core powers. So, for instance, even in the dissenting opinion by Sotomayor talking about assassinating political opponents using a SEAL Team 6 squad or those kinds of things. I think that some of that is a bit overstated. I can't imagine that there would be a court that would say that it falls within the core powers of the president to assassinate political opponents. So it's unlikely that those things are going to happen. But it certainly does increase protection and power for the president. There's no doubt about that. But what that's going to look like as it plays out in the future, some of this is. The lines are kind of blurry. So what counts as a core power? What's the outer what falls within the outer perimeter of the president's authority? What's a private action? So some of this isn't fully sorted out in the Chief Justice's opinion. But I think some of the worst expectations are certainly unlikely to come true.
Well, it's interesting to me because it's Trump versus United States, which means President Trump lost the previous round, right? And he appealed to the Supreme right. Court. Does this mean that this decision was breaking new ground for the court? Does this mean it was overturning previous precedent? Because I think a lot of our listeners might be thinking, wait, you mean the Supreme Court has never ruled on presidential immunity from criminal prosecution before?
Yeah, so this is breaking new ground. They're really, although there are past precedents, of course, dealt with presidential authority. And what the president is authorized to do, probably most famously, the Youngstown Sheet and Tube versus Sawyer case. And in some ways, you can see the Chief Justice's opinion mimicking the framework outlined by Justice Jackson in his concurrence in Youngstown, where he lays out, well, the president is at the peak of his authority, where there's clear statutory authorization from Congress, and then there's this twilight zone, and then he's at his weakest point when he's operating completely independently. Of course, the problem with that was it seems like most things are in the twilight zone, and you don't know exactly what to do with that. So you had that, and of course, there'd also been decisions on immunity from civil lawsuits. And the most recent one of those being with President Clinton and Paula Jones. And the Supreme Court said that the president is immune from civil lawsuits that fall within the president's relate to the president's constitutional authority, but is not immune from lawsuits that fall outside of that. And they said, of course, the litigation with Paula Jones fell outside of that. And so in some ways, I think you see this decision coming close to mimicking their approach to to immunity for civil lawsuits. And I think the rationale behind it is that if the president could constantly be charged or sued with civil lawsuits, during his presidency or even afterwards, it would severely hamstring and limit the president's authority to act under his or down the road, potentially her Article II powers. And so it's an inference of separation of powers that the president must have this authority and freedom to act in order to protect the executive function under our separation of power system.
Well, Josh, so this is interesting because what some people have argued here is, and you saw this in the, I saw this in the dissents that you were referring to in the administrative law cases, Loper Bright and others, you had dissenters, Sotomayor, Kagan, Justice Jackson saying, hey, it seems like the court should restrain itself. It seems like the court is taking on power that it shouldn't have. It should defer, for example, to the executive agencies when they make rules, and let's not unsettle precedent. Let's follow precedent and let's be restrained in our use of our judicial power. It seemed like in the old days, it was conservatives that accused liberals of being judicial activists and arguing in favor of the restraint. And now we seem to have the opposite. Is that true?
Yeah. So, well, it turns out that this whole debate about activism versus restraint has switched sides many times in our history. As you all know, the philosophy of judicial restraint was created by progressives, by progressive legal scholars, and who were concerned about the Supreme Court striking down economic regulations in the early 1900s. And so the philosophy of judicial restraint was initially associated with the left in the United States. Then you get to the second half of the 20th century, and you get the Warren Court and the Burger Courts that still continues much of the work that was done during the Warren Court era. And conservatives started arguing, they essentially dusted off the philosophy of judicial restraint that had been worked out by Thayer and Frankfurter and others, and say, that's our philosophy. And so then liberals became supportive of what could be called judicial activism. And now it seems to be reversing again a little bit. Now you have these accusations of activism from the right. Now, I think what the majority on the court would say is like, well, we aren't actually being activists because what we're trying to do is, for instance, with the administrative state decisions is, yes, it can increase the power of the judiciary, but the judiciary has the authority to say what the law is and interpret the law, and they shouldn't defer to agencies on that, who, after all, don't have constitutional authority. But they're also saying we're really trying to push power back to Congress and return some legislative authority. So even though they are overturning precedents and restraining the scope of administrative power, they would say that it's not activist in the normal or traditional sense of the word, because it's, again, trying to reinvigorate the legislative power.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
And how has that been squared with the decision in Trump versus the United States, which does seem to say the courts aren't going to be involved in criminal prosecution of the president? The president's got to be able, as you said, to be able to act without fear of not only civil lawsuit, but also criminal prosecution.
Yeah, so that obviously would limit what courts could do to intervene in presidential action. I mean, if you're saying that the president is immune from some areas of prosecution or criminal liability, then that inevitably has some effect of limiting judicial power.
Obviously, the Trump versus the United States was not, as you already mentioned, the only significant case involving President Trump. We have the other case of the January 6th situation and folks prosecuted there for their actions on January 6th. Tell us about that case.
Yes. So you have many people who were there on January 6th, entered the Capitol building, who ended up being charged. And they ended up being charged, many of them, with obstructing an official proceeding. And the statute that was used and the statute at issue in this case was Sarbanes-Oxley, which dealt with the financial markets. And the issue was evidence tampering. And you had a kind of odd lineup with this one because you had a 6-3 majority, but you had a reliable member of the conservative majority side with the liberal bloc, and that was Justice Barrett, and then a reliable member of the liberal bloc side with the conservative majority, and that was Justice Jackson. And what the majority said in this case is that the prosecutors were overreaching and applying this particular statute to these particular actions, and it's not clear that Congress intended to include them in the kinds of charges that could be brought in this case. And so that was the issue in this, and because the issue with Sarbanes-Oxley, were you tampering with evidence about some kind of financial misconduct in a case? What the majority said was that Sarbanes-Oxley was not intended to cover or to be able to be applied to this kind of criminal prosecution.
Well, it's really interesting because, so if our listeners are looking at this, what's the immediate legal effect then for the prosecution of these people? And then what's the more long-term effect of this decision?
There are several hundred people who have been charged under the Sarbanes-Oxley with January 6th are breathing a bit of a sigh of relief. There are probably other charges that are being brought against them as well, but this one is being removed from them. And so the immediate effect is that a lot of these trials, there's going to have to be some reconsideration if this was the only charge that was brought against them, or it's going to have to be dropped and they're going to have to continue with prosecution on other grounds if the Justice Department wants to do that.
Now, as you were saying, and I was sort of summarizing, it does seem true that a lot of these decisions are very legal decisions, very yep. kind of involved in separation of powers. I don't want to say technical, but they're about legal balances of powers and which branch should be doing which things. And as you said, one of the interesting right. themes is the court seems to be encouraging Congress to take more authority, especially to write clearer laws.
Yes, write clear laws and be much clearer about delegation of authority, so that agencies can't engage in a kind of expansion on their own of their power. So if an agency decides that it needs to address some issue and it's not clearly authorized in a statute, they have to go back to Congress. And you can see this with a series of decisions, but the most important being the Loper-Bright and then also the West Virginia versus EPA. This is clearly the implication of these.
How about hot button social issues? I think some of our listeners are wondering, sure. well, about big issues like social media regulation? What about the Second Amendment? Were there abortion cases? What are some other in the President Trump and the issues, cases involving him have had such a big media play? Maybe we've actually missed some of the other important decisions.
Yeah, so there were some significant free speech cases, some of them which did involve social media, but then also some which involved what you could call government coercion. Probably the most significant was NRA, National Rifle Association versus Gulo. It was a 9-0 decision. Justice Sotomayor wrote a unanimous opinion for the court, and what had happened is that officials in New York State had encouraged financial institutions in New York to not do business with the National Rifle Association. And Justice Sotomayor, in her opinion, said that officials may not use the power of the state to punish or suppress disfavored expression. And then she went on to say, at the heart of the First Amendment's free speech clause is the recognition that viewpoint discrimination is uniquely harmful to a free and democratic society. And so the position was the state can't go in and try to punish institutions, organizations that it does not like because of their viewpoint, and use that power to convince others to refuse services to them, that that is an unconstitutional violation of the First Amendment.
This is interesting. You said that the NRA decision was 9-0, written by Sotomayor, and this basic idea that viewpoint discrimination, that government can't favor or punish certain viewpoints, like the NRA's viewpoint, which is unpopular to the government of New York, obviously. There was another case called Murphy versus Missouri, if I'm not mistaken, which involved states bringing suit against the federal government for saying you're engaging in trying to suppress content that was critical of the federal government's efforts on coronavirus and pressuring social media companies to remove posts and things like that. How did that case end up?
Yes. So what happened there is that a 6-3 majority said that the state of Missouri and the other initial plaintiffs in the case did not have standing. And standing is essentially a doctrine that means that you must have an individualized stake in the matter or be able to show some kind of personal harm. It's supposed to be a threshold issue to get into court so that it really means that you can't just sue just because you don't like something. There's got you have to have, again, some kind of personal stake in the matter. And so it was a way of essentially avoiding deciding the issue. And so it didn't actually reach whether or not the government had behaved inappropriately or done something wrong. It just simply denied standing. And so if there is going to be some kind, if this issue is going to be considered by the court, you're going to essentially have to have different plaintiffs.
Yeah, it does seem to me, based on the NRA decision, that if a person could prove that the federal government, based on disfavoring their viewpoint, really did pressure a social media company to suppress their speech, that might run afoul of the First Amendment.
Oh, yeah. And there are cases going back for several decades now where you can argue that if you have a private actor who has submitted to government coercion to do the bidding of the government, that it essentially turns them into a state actor. And so the question is whether or not social media companies, in capitulating to the federal government's desire to censor particular viewpoints, had then essentially become a state actor, and then that would trigger First Amendment protections. Ordinarily, with a private entity, the First Amendment doesn't apply. Social media companies are private companies, and in many ways, just like you can decide what kind of speech is going to occur in your home, they can decide what kind of speech is going to occur on their platform. But again, if they capitulate to government pressure, that could then trigger a First Amendment violation.
And any other decisions? We sometimes have looked in the past at cases involving religious liberty, which had been a theme, important theme in previous years, previous terms, separation of church and state, big religion and constitution issues. Those seem to have been pretty quiet this term.
Yes, there wasn't really much on religion. There were a couple of abortion decisions, so a hot button social issue, so issue about emergency abortions in Idaho, and the Supreme Court essentially said that Idaho has to allow this. The issue, another case involving the abortion pill or one of the abortion pills, FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, 9-0 opinion. This is another one where they decided on standing. They said that the organization, this Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, didn't have standing to bring the lawsuit. You had a partisan gerrymandering case, which was significant. It was Alexander versus State Conference of the NAACP. And this was a 6-3 decision. And they said that reiterated that partisan gerrymandering is not unconstitutional. And the issue in this case was that there was a claim that there was racial gerrymandering. that Republicans in South Carolina had drawn a district on racial lines in order to improve the chances of a Republican winning, but that would disfavor Black voters. And the court said that you really couldn't distinguish between the partisan motivations here from any kind of racial motivations. And so really the Republicans were just trying to punish Democrats with the gerrymandering, and therefore that this district was not unconstitutional. So you had a homeless camping decision, City of Grants Pass versus Johnson, where the court said that it is acceptable for local governments to criminalize camping on public property. So that was a bit of a social issue. And then you also had the Trump ballot eligibility case, where, you know, Trump had been excluded from the ballot in Colorado, and then some other states like Michigan and Maine had also tried to exclude him. But in a 9-0 decision in Trump versus Anderson, the Supreme Court said that Colorado could not do this. So those were, those are some pretty significant issues. And but again, you're right that some of these other issues, church state issues, don't seem to have played as big a role this time around. I know that there are some cases that are moving their way through the courts that are likely to raise some establishment clause and free exercise clause issues. But we didn't see much of that this term.
I always love to ask you, because not all our listeners obviously are close scholars of the Supreme Court like you, and they don't follow the cases as they go through term by term. But was there this decision, this term, a decision that surprised you? You were not expecting the court to rule on it, or you were not expecting the court to rule that way? Or is it no longer possible for the court to surprise Josh Dunn?
No, I was surprised. There was a case, it involved the administrative state again, but this one, they upheld what was being challenged. It was Consumer Financial Protection Bureau versus Community Financial Services Association of America. And as you know, this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, there have been challenges before to its constitutionality. One previous challenge to the CFPB was whether the director of it could be unaccountable to the president, essentially, and really not removable by the president. The Supreme Court said that was unconstitutional. But this challenge in Consumer Financial Protection Bureau versus Community Financial Services Association was about the funding mechanism, because the funding for the CFPB really comes not directly from the Treasury. And so the question is whether or not that receiving this alternative form of funding also violates principles of separation of powers as kind of a loophole, and the Supreme Court upheld the funding mechanism. So that was a little surprising, because given its previous decisions on the CFPB, I thought there's a chance that they would strike that down. After oral argument, though, what I remember reading about it, I was less confident that the court would strike it down. It seemed to be a little bit more, but it ended up being a 7-2 decision. So a fairly healthy majority in that case.
So, Josh, I mean, that's very interesting, talking about this court's term, of course, and a lot of our listeners are thinking, well, it's an election year, a presidential election year. Obviously, President Trump's already been a major litigant in front of the Supreme Court. But they're looking at the presidential election upcoming in November, thinking, what effect might that election have on the Supreme Court?
So it all depends on what vacancies might emerge on the court. So who is most likely to retire first? I think that if you were to poll court watchers, the justice that would get mentioned most often would be Justice Sotomayor. That she might be the first to retire. And there are different reasons for that, some of it entirely speculative, but you also see some people on the left. Remember when Obama was leaving office, some people said that Justice Ginsburg should retire. so that Obama could name her replacement. She, of course, didn't expect Trump to win. So there was some talk that she wanted to wait to retire in with the expectation that Hillary Clinton would win. And so her replacement could be named by the first female president. But you've heard a little bit of that same kind of chatter with Sotomayor, which you never know. It could just be that people are worried on the left that Sotomayor might be in poor health or might face some health concerns and sooner than we might think. And because you just look at her age, maybe she should just retire, giving Biden a chance to replace her. There has been talk about that happening. I don't think she's going to do that, though. But she looks like the first one who might be replaced. And of course, if she does retire, and Trump wins, that would give him a chance to add another conservative to the court. And the last time when he was dealing with Supreme Court nominations, he really left it to the conservative legal movement to come forward with names that he would then choose. A lot of people from the Federalist Society played a significant role in this. I think there is maybe a question about whether or not he would still cede that kind of control to the Federalist Society. That would give him a chance to appoint someone who could give a working 7-2 majority on the court. And of course, if whoever the Democratic candidate is right now, there's speculation that Biden might have to step down from the ticket. But let's say Biden stays on the ticket and wins. There would be a good chance that Sotomayor would retire, just allow them to maintain that three-person block of liberal justices on the court. And then, of course, on the left, there'd be some hope that some of the more conservative justices might retire. You look at Kagan and Jackson, they both seem in fairly good health and pretty young by Supreme Court standards, so it doesn't look like they're going anywhere. So then you would look to some justices on the conservative side who might be next in line based on just their age. And so you're going to do some actuarial analysis to try to figure out who might be next to retire.
And I've heard some speculation that maybe he's now the longest serving Justice Thomas. If President Trump were to win again, that he might retire to allow Trump appoint his replacement.
Right. Yeah, there does seem to be some calculation on the part of justices. They would prefer to have their replacement named by someone that they are more likely to agree with, or who would be more likely to appoint someone whose judicial philosophy they agree with. There was some indication that happened with Justice Kennedy, that he knew that Trump was likely to nominate someone like Kavanaugh, who was one of his clerks. So he was more comfortable retiring. So yes, that's and obviously, if you sit on the Supreme Court for as long as they want to have a lasting effect, and one way to undo what you've done is by staying on too long, leaving someone who doesn't agree with your judicial philosophy or your politics to name your replacement. So it would not be surprising to see some of the conservative justices who are a little bit more advanced chronologically to retire, to give Trump the opportunity to name their replacement.
Well, clearly, that's fascinating. Clearly, the presidential election will have a significant effect on the Supreme Court and on the lower federal courts as well. Always a lot of judges appointed there as well. Wow, what a fascinating term this has been. Complicated, really interesting, but as you said, could have really profound long-term effects on the separation of powers in our constitutional system. Josh Dunn, thanks as always for taking the time to join us for a look at this most recent Supreme Court term.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.